first for myself, I was like, how can they convict me of a crime that never happened? So I really didn't think anything would come of it. But when my attorney had told me, you know, they don't have anything on you, Ramirez, you don't have to worry about anything, I was okay.
And that's Elizabeth Ramirez, one of four women known as the San Antonio Four. In the early 1990s, Elizabeth and three friends, all of whom are lesbians, were charged and convicted of a horrible crime. They were accused of molesting Elizabeth's two young nieces.
And then when I was on the stand and the prosecutor started just badgering me about, you're a lesbian and you did this and you did that and you're capable of doing this. And then he started just painting the whole picture as sacrificing my nieces on the altar. And we were just like all doing different things to them. And it was like, it was crazy. I was like, I couldn't believe everything that they were saying.
Since it all started in 1994, Elizabeth and her friends have strongly maintained their innocence. They claim that they were targeted because of their sexual orientation. It was a moment in American history steeped in fear about children getting sexually assaulted while they were in someone else's care, and a lot of the accusations were tinged with homophobia. Now, after 20 years of pleading for help and asserting that they didn't commit the crime, the San Antonio Four may finally be proven right. From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, from the Latino USA archives, the story of the San Antonio Four. Now, before we get started, I need to mention that the story you're about to hear contains descriptions of sexual assault and crimes against children. So, what exactly happened to the San Antonio Four? Four lesbians accused of sexual assault who served almost two decades in prison for a crime they say they didn't commit. Latino USA producer Julia Hsu has been working with me on this story for several weeks now. So, Julia, take us to the beginning.
So we have to go back to 1994. Elizabeth Ramirez was 20 years old. She lived in San Antonio, Texas, and she worked a lot of fast food and retail jobs. And Elizabeth was openly gay.
And I had my first girlfriend, which my family pretty much didn't agree with.
Elizabeth fought with her mom a lot, and she actually had to move out of her house as a teenager. But she was rarely alone. Her friends Christy Mayhew and Cassie Rivera came around often, especially because Cassie had also been kicked out of her house.
I'm Cassandra Rivera.
Hi, I'm Anna Vasquez.
Their friend Anna Vasquez was around too. She and Cassie were dating. Anna was 19 and Cassie was 20. The four friends were all lesbians, and what's more, they were out, which was not only uncommon in Texas at that time, but it was dangerous.
People labeled us as, you know, very bad people just because of who we are.
There was times when I would actually go to the gay clubs and people were outside gay bashing. So, I mean, it wasn't anything that anyone accepted at all.
For Cassie, that meant keeping her relationship with Anna private.
I knew that I was in love with this woman, but the way it was frowned upon, we weren't allowed to be who we wanted to be.
Even when Cass and I did come out, we weren't really fully out. We were out to our friends.
We would be stared at. We would be talked about. We were judged. We were criticized.
Even though her mom didn't like the fact that she was gay, Elizabeth did keep up a relationship with her family. Sometimes she would help out her sister Rosemary by babysitting her two nieces. The two girls were 7 and 9 years old. And because Elizabeth's friends were in and out of her apartment so much, they would help watch the girls too.
Everything was fine until one day Elizabeth heard a knock on the door. It was a detective from the San Antonio Police Department. Elizabeth was brought in for questioning because she was being accused of sexually assaulting her nieces. In fact, all four women were charged with being under the influence of drugs and alcohol and charged with forcing the nieces to participate in a demonic sex orgy.
In this court document obtained by CNN, the little girls claimed they were raped during a drug-fueled satanical rage with a gun pointed at their heads. They said the four women held them down, inserting objects, sexually assaulting them.
The details were graphic. The girl's father, Javier Limon, said that they had reported the attack to him, and so he had called the police.
I called my mom right away, and I told her, I can't believe.
That's Rosemary Camarillo, Elizabeth's sister and the mother of the girls.
Because I know that my sister and her friends were not capable of doing anything like that, and I knew from day one that they were innocent.
Right away, Rosemary thought that the accusations were being made up by her ex-boyfriend, Javier Limon. She and Javier had been in a custody battle over the kids, and Rosemary says that Javier was obsessed with her sister, Elizabeth, that he was writing her love letters.
Because at the time he had said that, you know, that he would father her child, and that he thought in his mind that he could change her from being a lesbian.
We reached out to Javier for this story many times, but didn't get a response. But in 2014, he told a reporter from the Texas Observer that his alleged love letters to Elizabeth were forged.
The prosecutors who handled the case of the San Antonio Four claimed that sexual orientation had nothing to do with it.
But the San Antonio Four felt otherwise.
Here's Anna.
Even prior to the trial, even when we're being interrogated and our statements, you know, have a lot of, well, she's gay, Liz is gay, Cassie's gay. And it's like, why is that important at this point? And, you know, I had my attorneys, my defense attorneys telling me to put on a dress and, you know, fix my hair and put some makeup on. So even the people that are supposed to be defending me are telling me to tone it down because I look too gay.
And then there was the medical component. A doctor had done a medical exam on one girl and found a small mark on her hymen. The doctor said this was a clear sign of assault, which had a lot of credibility at that time. And then there's also the testimony of the two nieces, who talked about being threatened, locked up, and raped. In the first trial, their statements didn't match up. And as time passed, their stories grew more and more inconsistent. In one version, Christy hadn't been there. Later, they said she was. And one girl said Elizabeth had a gun, but later said Anna had the gun. But still, it was a terrifying story of assault and violence, and the prosecutors said they were too young and traumatized to know every detail.
And so with the testimony of these two little girls, the conviction was sealed for the San Antonio Four. And it wasn't that surprising, not only because the testimony had been so specific and harrowing, but also because of the period of time. Now, remember, we mentioned that the country was going through this moment of extreme panic around sexual abuse of children that was mixed with fear around satanic rituals, that was also mixed with, well, homophobia. And it was happening so much at the time that it even got a name. It was called the Satanic Panic.
It appears satanic worship may have played a role in the murders.
Do you feel that the people that did this were worshiping
Satan? Yes, I do.
It's alleged that a living creature was sacrificed on the church's altar.
And they had all types of wild homosexual orgies, I've been told. Crazy things.
In California in 1983, there was the McMartin case, when a daycare was accused of assaulting children. It was a 7-year-long trial that included testimony from kids about seeing witches fly. 10 years later, there were the West Memphis Three, three teenagers convicted of raping and murdering children, allegedly because they were members of a satanic cult. After serving 18 years in prison, they were released when new DNA evidence was discovered and they got a plea deal.
In fact, the San Antonio Four trial is one of the last times the words satanic sex orgy were used in a criminal case.
In separate verdicts, Elizabeth, Cassie, Christy, and Anna were all found guilty of aggravated sexual assault of a child and indecency with a child. Here's Rosemary again. She's the mom of the two alleged victims and the sister of Elizabeth.
And up to this day, I still remember when they convicted my sister, where she just like yelled out, tell them that I'm innocent. Tell them I didn't do anything to y'all. You know that I loved y'all. I would never do anything to hurt y'all. her words are like engraved in my mind of that day that she got convicted. And my mom just screamed out and she almost fainted out on us in the hallway when she ran out. I mean, we couldn't believe it.
It was especially devastating for Cassie and Elizabeth because going to prison meant leaving behind their own kids. For Cassie, two children, and for Elizabeth, a baby boy. Elizabeth went to prison in 1997, her friends in the year 2000, but they always held on to their claims of innocence.
There was never a day that I just never fought or looked for strength from God to continue with this struggle or with this journey. You know, it was never one day that I would ever give up on my freedom, because I had three friends that were incarcerated with me, and I had my family and my son at home. So that was my strength every day to go forward and say I wasn't giving up, and the truth will one day come forward.
To maintain their innocence, some of the women refused to participate in sex offender rehabilitation courses, so they were denied parole. Elizabeth says she wrote about her case to every advocacy organization she could and to TV shows like Oprah and Maury Povich, but no one responded.
But then someone finally did. Coming up on Latino USA, how a pen pal from the Yukon Territory in Canada changed everything for the San Antonio Four. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, tackling the big economic questions every day.
Back with the story of the San Antonio Four. Now, when we left off last, Elizabeth Ramirez, Cassie Rivera, Ana Vasquez, and Christy Mayhew, also known as the San Antonio Four, were in prison after being convicted of sexually assaulting two little girls who were Elizabeth's nieces. All four accused women insisted on their innocence, and they ended up writing to several advocacy groups asking for their help.
But they got no answers. As the years passed, Elizabeth turned to the internet.
So I got on thewriterprisoners.com, and I put an ad up. I prayed, and I was like, okay, God, everybody that writes me on this website, I write everyone back.
Elizabeth started writing back and forth with a pen pal in the far-off Yukon Territory in Canada. The man asked about her case, and what's more, he believed in her innocence. He took all the information he could find on the San Antonio Four to an organization in New York called
the National Center for Reason and Justice,
or the NCRJ.
We're a nonprofit that works on combating panic around issues of endangerment to children.
That's Debbie Nathan. Debbie's a journalist and also is the director of the NCRJ. She was immediately struck by Elizabeth's story because this is something she has an expertise in.
So I was very, very familiar with the kind of panic that leads to these cases. We often call them ritual abuse cases because there's a sort of a scenario in the claim. People who don't seem to have any kind of a criminal record are accused of doing really bizarre, really violent things to children. And yet the evidence is very, very mushy, if not non-existent.
In 1995, Debbie wrote a book called Satan's Silence about the satanic panic. And one of the other cases that she had researched involved two straight women, daycare staff in El Paso in the mid-1980s.
I mean, these women were so straight. They were just these, like, middle-aged ladies. They sat around, like, stringing popcorn, you know, on strings to put on Christmas trees. And they were married and had kids. Everyone said they have to be gay. That's the explanation.
The satanic panic also had to do with changing social norms. More and more women were joining the workforce, which means more and more kids were being put into daycare.
And there was a huge panic about daycare, and it started with a lot of stories, including in the women's magazines, about physical abuse of kids in daycare and also about the psychological effects of kids being in daycare. So then it sort of like turned over into this sex abuse thing.
Debbie had actually been a reporter in San Antonio during the years that Elizabeth and her friends were in court, but it wasn't on anyone's radar.
It did a lot of stories about local homophobia, and I never heard of this case. This case apparently just sank, like in a swamp.
Debbie was appalled to think that this case had been happening right under her nose, and she hadn't known.
So she and the NCRJ took on the case of the San Antonio Four, trying to get support for Elizabeth and her convicted friends.
Everything in San Antonio seemed locked up, including the gay rights movement. They had no interest in this case, which was not unusual at the time because gay civil rights movements and organizations nationally are extremely reluctant to challenge accusations of child sex abuse. They're terrified because part of homophobia in this culture has always been to say that homosexual men and lesbian women have a propensity to sexually abuse children. So gay rights groups traditionally haven't wanted to touch this with a 10-foot pole, and that was true in San Antonio.
But finally, the San Antonio Four story caught the attention of a local reporter who published an article about the case.
A few days after it came out, I remember I was walking around on 8th Street here in New York, and my phone rang.
It was from one of the alleged victims.
And she just wanted to recant.
We reached out multiple times to both girls for this story. They're now adults, but we didn't get a response. However, we did talk to their mom, Rosemary, who remembers talking to the daughter who recanted her testimony.
And she's like, "Mom, nothing ever happened. Nothing ever happened. I remember all the good stuff that I did with my tia Lisa. That she would take us shopping, that she would make, you know, scrambled eggs with cheese for us."
Rosemary says her daughters were given false stories by their dad. And at the same time, another big part of the case started to fall apart. The medical testimony that previously cited a mark on one girl's hymen as a sign of abuse was discredited. Medical experts now believe that such marks can happen naturally.
Ana Vasquez had already been released on parole in 2012. But given this changed evidence, a judge released the other three women on bail in November of 2013. When they walked out, Elizabeth had spent almost 17 years in prison. For Christy and Cassie, it was 13 years. Finally free, Cassie met her granddaughter for the very first time.
Oh, my God.
But being released doesn't mean their lives have gone back to normal. The crimes the women were convicted of still stand, despite the recanted testimony and the changed medical evidence. The case is technically still open while they wait for the final step, a decision from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals to vacate their convictions. Until that happens, the cloud of doubt still hangs over their heads.
I still have that in the back of my mind telling me, you never know when things might change. And what if it's taken from me again? You know, I have a 37-and-a-half-year sentence. I can't just go out and travel anywhere without getting approved by the judge to sign paperwork.
Everything you do now, you have to apply online. You know, if you just look online and you see an application and it says, convicted sexual offender, I mean, people aren't going to hire you.
Still, they've all done their best to live as fully as they can now. Elizabeth has a job in a manufacturing plant. Anna works at a tortilla factory. And Cassie is a delivery driver. and they're rebuilding family relationships, or sometimes creating brand new ones. Elizabeth's focus now is on her son. He's in college and about to leave for the Marines, but for almost 17 years, she never saw him.
Yeah, he was 2 years old when I left, and he was 18 when I came home. And so I never had any interaction with him whatsoever. I never had any visits or anything. So that was one of the hardest things as well.
Of course, not every relationship can be healed. Rosemary believes her daughters, the alleged victims of the assault, were scarred permanently. Remember, they were only 7 and 9 years old when the case began.
They got so much anger in them. I can't even keep a relationship with my daughters because of all this.
Rosemary says she hasn't spoken to one daughter in a year and the other daughter in 10 years.
The, quote, satanic panic might have subsided, but its fallout lives on. What happened in San Antonio in 1994 has cast a long shadow for Rosemary, her daughters, and, of course, for the San Antonio Four themselves. We first reported and aired this story in 2016. About a year after it came out, the San Antonio Four got major news. It was the day that they had hoped for. In the court's opinion, the judge said that the San Antonio Four had won, quote, the right to proclaim to the citizens of Texas that they did not commit a crime, that they are innocent, that they deserve to be exonerated.
After that big moment, we wondered how Elizabeth was doing, so I called her.
Hello.
Hi, Elizabeth. This is Julia.
Hi, how's it going? Hi, I'm Julia.
I talked to Elizabeth on the phone. It was super hot in our studio in New York and in Texas.
I was talking to the air conditioner guys, and they were just telling me about the AC. It's froze over, so they're trying to get it thawed out. There's two things that I told myself I didn't want to suffer, which to have, you know, be in the heat all the time and be forever cold.
Elizabeth was in the middle of some home repairs. She actually bought the home back in September.
So little by little, you know, I've been kind of furnishing it, getting sofas and TVs and little stuff here and there.
Those are all the things Elizabeth had held off on buying before the exoneration. And now things have changed. So I wanted to hear more about what that big moment was like when she found out about the court's decision. It happened kind of magically the day before Thanksgiving.
I was asleep and my phone rang and there was a text message and I was like, it said we won. I was like, what? Oh my gosh. My son was asleep in his room and I was screaming and I was crying and he was like, Mom, what's wrong? And I told him, finally, it's over. We had Thanksgiving and my mom was like, today's the day to be grateful and thankful. And so we did our family prayer and she was like, I want you to do the prayer. And so we sat there on the table and we had hands and we prayed. And I mean, it was just awesome. It was like, this is the day of Thanksgiving, you know?
Since finding out about that, how has your life changed?
Oh, it's changed a lot. Now it's like, I don't get up scared anymore, wondering, you know, am I going to be taken away? And now, like, I'm able to be more involved with my son. He just graduated from basic training, so he's in Missouri right now doing some more training. You know, there's a chance that I might see him again. I mean, that was, like, the biggest obstacle. I was getting to wash his clothes and cook for him, and I didn't even care if he cleaned his room. I would clean it 1,000 times for him if I had to. I did that chance that I had to be able to share that with him. It was like, meant the world to me, you know? For me to be able to be a part of his life was, like, more reassuring.
Elizabeth is finally planning family vacations, something she could never do when she was waiting to clear her name. And there was another thing that she was putting off, getting married.
Well, actually, I had met her in prison, and she came home a couple years ago, and we just kind of picked up where we left off.
Elizabeth's partner's name is Angel Sanchez. Since getting out of prison, they've been living together in Elizabeth's new house, and Angel kept asking Elizabeth to marry her.
She was like, why can't we? I'll be there for you. And I was like, I can't. I'm sorry. And then now that we got the exoneration, and she asked me, she was like, will you marry me now? And I looked at her, and I was like, yes, I'll marry you now. That look in her was like finally like that relief, like finally we can go on. Now it's like taking the next step.
Elizabeth is enrolling in college this fall to study criminal justice. But her life is still recovering. She told me that night she got the text about the court decision, after celebrating, crying, hugging her son, she said there was a minute that she just sat down and thought, what's next? And she still has those feelings.
I'll be in bed and I'm like, wow, I'm here. And then I think about everything and I'm sitting there, you know, Liz, you got to get up, you got to go to work, you got to keep going. You know, you fight for so long, for so many years, and then finally you're like, okay, now what do I do?
What you do is you just live life. A life with family vacations on the 4th of July, with school, weddings, and AC units that break when it's hot. After struggling with one of the toughest fights of her life, no wonder it feels weird for Elizabeth to be facing the normal, everyday problems we all deal with. But really, that's what she was fighting for all along.
Today, the four women are still friends. They see each other often for birthdays and at Innocence Project events. They all attended Elizabeth's wedding in February, and Cassie was Elizabeth's maid of honor. This episode was reported and produced by Julia Hsu and edited by Nadia Raymond. That's it for today. The Latino USA team includes Andres Caballero, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. Production help this week from Ashley Cleek. Our senior editor is Marlon Bishop. Our engineers are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our senior production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our fellows are Maya Cueva and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. And a fond goodbye this week to our intern, Reese Williams. Hey, Reese, thank you for everything. It was a joy having you in the office, and good luck in your next endeavors. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music that you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Here we go. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, we talk about the Me Too movement and the recent allegations against Juno Diaz.
There can be an impulse to say, like, you know, this person is dead to us forever. And I want to push us because ultimately there's so much woundedness in our community.
That's next time on Latino USA.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.